Donalana Kitchen talks about food. Donalana Kitchen talks recipes. Donalana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Donalana Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas. Support comes from Wheatsfield Co-op, your full-service natural foods grocer in Ames, community-owned, community-focused since 1974, open daily 7 a.m., 9 p.m., located downtown at 413 Northwestern, just off Main Street in Ames. Everyone can shop Wheatsfield Co-op.
Today on the Donalana Kitchen, around our kitchen table, we'll be talking about the local plate. What grows here? What grows in our bioregion? How does it sustain us? I have a little bit of, I brought in some show and tell, or should we say eat and tell here, because I have something in a very, very small way sustaining me during these past few weeks. And it took some planning, but there it is. I have some cherry tomatoes growing in my living room. And it can be done. It can be done. These are not, they don't taste like summer tomatoes, but this time of year.
But they're a cute color.
They are great. They are great. I broke off a stem of a sun gold cherry tomato way last fall, stuck it in a pot. It didn't like winter at all. It just sat there and sat there. But long about February, it took off. And now on strings and on climbing up the edge of the window, it's taking over one of my south-facing windows, and it has decided to give me lots of little tomatoes. That's a good thing. Out in the garden, there's onions, there's leeks, there's shallots to be planted, spinach and lettuce, and I'm trying fava beans this year for the first time. We'll see how that goes.
Oh, boy, oh, boy.
We'll see how that goes.
I love fava beans, but they are the most tedious thing in the world to cook and clean.
Right, right. We'll talk about those in the future. I'm going to learn a lot about this. I have another sign of spring. It's been going on for quite some time in my neighborhood. It doesn't sound very appetizing, but I want to talk to you folks about frost heaving. It is a phenomenon. And for those of you who seldom get to travel on a gravel road, here's something to remind us that the earth below our feet, or earth below our car tires, is a dynamic thing. Often in the spring, our gravel lane, and I live on a house at the end of a gravel lane that's about a quarter mile long, shared with some other neighbors. And many years we have frost heaves, and it's just like what it sounds. There's this boiling sort of looking action. There's this water coming up, and it's not in a low spot in the landscape at all. This is on the top of a ridge, as a matter of fact, right in the middle of this gravel driveway. It's a muddy, boiling-looking wet thing that has not
How
dried.
Big is it?
Oh, it's about 4 feet wide, and it's about 30 feet long.
Oh, my goodness.
It's amazing.
This sounds like a major local attraction.
It is. It is. I'm thinking I should maybe set up a souvenir stand and sell tickets. This is good.
Oh, I'm coming.
Oh,
I'm
frosty. It looks like a cold mud spa, and it is dynamic because every day it sort of changes. Some of our neighbors try to drive over it with a tire and squash it down, but by the next day it's boiling up again. And judging by past years, it will go away eventually. What causes it, and I had to look this up, frost heaving is an upward swelling of soil during freezing conditions caused by ice as it grows toward the surface. And this only happens in frost-susceptible soils. If it's too sandy, the water flows away, no problem. If it's too clay, the water never gets in there in the first place.
So it must be in your perfect loamy,
loamy soil. Right.
Mm-hmm.
But this is right in the middle of a gravel driveway. You wouldn't think. It's this wet mud.
Maybe I won't
up.
Be driving my little Mini Cooper
no,
down
be
your
careful.
Lane.
we have been driving around. Because one year we did get a rather big gravel truck stuck in a frost boil, or I call it frost. The neighbors called it a frost boil or a frost heave. Be careful of those things. And it happens in gravel roads. Actually, it happens many places. Also, the term frost boil is actually, I found this out, It is more often attributed to what happens in the tundra, in the permafrost. There's little pockets of things that never really dry out, and there's ice and there's water, there's ice and there's water, there's freeze and thaw and freeze and thaw, and things get pushed up. So there's things going on underneath our feet.
Geologic dynamics. It reminds me of the first, in my California days, the earthquake experiences. You know, this earth that we always feel is so solid and, you know, our underpinnings here, when it moves of its own accord, it's always paradigm shattering, as it were.
A humbling experience.
Absolutely. Ooh. And this is the International Year of the Soils.
Oh.
So we can really be concentrating on understanding and being more appreciative of the constant dynamic that is going in, little known to us as we trod the earth.
Right, right. So here's to frost heaving around here, and I hope everything dries up soon.
Not too dry.
Last week there was a whirlwind of food and flavors here in central Iowa. We got visited by author Ava Chen, who talked about foraging wild foods, and she was wonderful to talk to. That was on our last Donnell in the Kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
And followed up on her heels was a visit to Ames and a lecture by
Dan Barber.
Explain who Dan Barber is.
Okay,
Donna.
Dan Barber is, I would say, certainly one of the most noted chefs in the country, if not the world. He works with Fred Kirschman at the Stone Barn Center just out of New York City. Plus, he has also a Blue Hill restaurant in New York City. And as he himself notes, he is kind of the poster child for the farm-to-table food movement. So we had a Shivers lecture, and we will give the recording, what's it called? Where you can look it up on
podcast?
Yeah, you can listen to it on the internet. And Lana, do you have that?
Yes. He gave a lecture on campus last Wednesday. It was the 8th of April. That can be found at www.iastate.edu/lecture/34766. Or go to iastate.edu/lectures, and you can probably type in Dan Barber. They have a pretty good filing system.
Yeah, so
there.
We think it's either about to be posted there or will be shortly. So the after party, because it was the Leopold Center Shivers lecture series presented Dan. So we had the little Shivers, the charming, actually adorable Shivers family over.
Yes, the Shivers are the Shivers family are currently sisters, and they are landowners, and
somewhere around Knoxville, I think.
Yeah, Knoxville, and their father and their family endowed a lecture series.
From the 70s or 60s or something. This is really ongoing.
Very
foresightful of that father.
They have been supporting good food and sustainable agriculture and talking about it and getting people on campus and lectures and things like that for a long time. So Dan Barber gave a lovely lecture, and he talked about eating from the whole farm, achieving a sustainable food system through pleasure. He says that I want to change the world, but I want this to be fun. I'm a hedonist.
And delicious. Totally delicious.
I love to do this. If things taste good, they'll have good nutrition, and that means so it's good ecology to go along with it. Things that are pleasurable to eat.
And good for you.
The
pleasure of good health, the pleasure of delicious flavor, and the pleasure of maintaining our beautiful environment.
Right. So he used the term eating nose to tail on the whole farm. Nose to tail is a concept of using the whole animal, not just taking the steaks.
Right,
but
eating the tail, the hooves, and we do use all of those parts.
Yes, hot dogs and bacon, and you don't want to waste anything.
Gelatin,
and you want
bone meal,
bone
broth.
And the idea of using everything from the whole farm also includes cover crops, things that are good for the soil, not just the main high-value crop. He used the concept of taking the wheat. The wheat is what we wanted for bread. But to get that wheat, a really good farmer has a whole process, a whole bunch of other things.
Multiple years of crop rotation.
Yes, and they're all edible. And so let's learn to eat what grows here.
So we had a little party after Dan's lecture at my house. And, of course, I had to cook for Dan Barber.
Oh, Donna, what did you cook?
Oh, it was so much fun, I have to tell you. I'm going to kind of describe the process of constructing a menu for an event like this. First of all, you have to consider whom you're cooking for. So since I completely agree with his politics of food, I wanted everything to be as local as possible and show him what our community has specifically. And we have a lot. Unfortunately, it's our least show-off time of year. So we were scrambling, but good effort was made by a lot of people.
I'd call it a really good challenge, and you met it with flying colors.
Absolutely. It was a major group activity. So, and then the event was a late evening supper. So it was not a sit down. It was more like a buffet. And so I had all of these things, and it was about 25 people in my home. So, you know, it's not like we have a wait staff there or, you know, front of the house or anything. So it's like, okay, here was my goal. Get it set up, run over to the lecture, run back home, and finish the thing, you know, right? And then also be able to enjoy the event, for goodness sakes. So here's kind of what we did for the menu. I started off with I called Kevin Dietzel from Lost Lake Farm, who is a new up-and-coming, and somewhere in the not-too-distant future, you will be seeing his cheeses. He made some camembert-type cheeses, so we had a nice cheese board with Kevin's cheeses, and they were lovely. I mean, We are now making lots of good cheddars and things like that around here. But to have a domestic soft wash rind cheese, it was really a treat. So Kevin brought the cheese, and then I used Mary's duck eggs. So I broke the eggs out of the shell and saved the shell to serve that. So I made a duck egg salad. So I kind of scrambled it up and then chopped it, and then I went out into the meager garden that's sprouting up, and we cut out some garlic chives and a little lovage and mixed it in with some mayonnaise. And so we had like a little duck egg salad in the eggs, in the egg carton. That was the display.
Oh, you had, how did you boiled the egg first, or you dumped out? Broke the eggs.
I actually, you know, duck. Why I like duck eggs, part of the fun is they have really thick shells, and they're slightly larger. So I kind of tried to cut. I would crack it, and then I went in with my kitchen shears and cut the top third off and then poured the egg out. And then I boiled the eggshell, so I had a little container.
Oh, so they sat on their end, and they just sat up there so pretty?
Yeah, and then I cooked the eggs kind of separately and chopped them up. So it was like a hard-boiled egg salad, but it wasn't hard-boiled egg.
Oh, and not everyone has duck eggs. And you said you got it Mary's
Farm to Folk. Isn't it Mary's duck eggs?
Mary's Farm.
Mary's Farm at Farm to Folk. So we had duck egg salad with garlic, chive, and lemon mayonnaise. Okay. Now, the next trick that I wanted to do is Fred Kirschemann, who's the distinguished fellow at the Leopold Center, was the host for the evening. And Fred is, in addition to being at the Leopold Center and living in Ames, he's also the director of the board at Stone Barns. So he's the one that brought Dan here, and it's actually their collaboration that I think produces this wonderful, thought-provoking food system analysis, right?
As part of the lecture, Fred Kirschemann and Dan actually kind of got away from the microphone behind the podium, and they sat in two comfy chairs up there on the stage and had a wonderful discussion.
Yes.
So
Fred is also a North Dakota farmer, and I think that Dan had never had Fred's beef. So I wanted a dish that would feature Fred's beef. Now, Fred's beef has this marvelous flavor. You know, it's all grown, and some of it, I think, is never plowed prairie, and it's all grass-fed. But grass-fed beef can be a little less tender than, you know, some of the beef we have around here. So what I wanted to do is make a beef dish that really showed the flavor and was not, you know, I wanted it, so I didn't want to do a stew or something where you're just, you know, boiling the heck out of it. So I decided to try to make a carpaccio.
Oh, what now, is a carpaccio?
Carpaccio is usually you take like a filet mignon, which is a kind of, you know, circular, round, very tender piece of steak, and you marinate it, and then you very high heat sear it on the outside so that it's quite pink on the inside and quite nicely seared around the edge. Then you slice it very, very, very thin. And then maybe put just a little marinade or something over it. And it, so it's these usually these nice little circles that are about 3 inches in diameter served just on a plate or sometimes on a salad or something like that. So we're looking in Fred's freezer to get the best steak we can do for this. And, of course, they're all cut kind of North Dakota style, which means they're all about an inch thick, right? So I'm going, okay. But we got to work with what is. So we get the steaks, and I do marinate them, and then I take them out about 24 hours. I used apple juice and tamari, and then I – so they're marinated. Then you freeze them.
Oh, my goodness. You marinate how long?
About 24 hours.
Okay, and then freeze them. Okay.
And then freeze them. Oh, no, wait. I did that wrong. You marinate them, then you pat them dry, and then you sear them.
Okay.
So, I mean, I set the smoke alarms off doing this, you know, because you've got to have – you want it really hot on the outside. So it looks like a cooked piece of steak, but you still want it very pink on the inside. So I seared them really fast, and then I froze them.
Oh, now that's really unusual to marinate, cook, and then freeze.
Well, the reason you freeze them is then you put them through the meat slicer, and you can cut them paper thin.
Oh, so it's the texture or it's the handling quality that you want.
Well, yeah, you want to cut them, you know, kind of against the grain and very thin so that they become tender.
Mm-hmm.
And then we made lovely platters with ramps, decorated with ramps and other spring greens and kind of folded them into little rosettes. So we had the platter of what I call the North Dakota carpaccio. The next dish that we worked on was Adam – what's Adam's last name?
Wilkie.
Adam Wilkie, our forager, our lovely, lovely young man forager, brought me two rabbits. So I made something I was calling a rabbit rillette. Now, a rillette is traditionally a French – it's kind of like a potted meat, and it's usually done with – pork is the most common. And you cook it till it's, you know – till you can pull it apart practically into mush and you shred it with your fingers. So I cooked those rabbits with, you know, rabbits don't have much fat. So I used pancetta, the LaQuercia pancetta, and just roasted them till they fell off the bone. And I think I also put in some Gary Guthrie carrots and a little vermouth and a little marjoram, salt and pepper. You know, I was kind of trying to deepen the flavor. Oh, and I used a lot of those garlic chives, which are the only onion I have in the sprouting up. Right, they come up first. So,
oh, and I'm glad they do because this time of year they're just absolutely wonderful.
Oh, they're delicious.
They're wonderful, and you can't get more local than rabbit. I think. Well, the past few years it's like we've been knee deep in rabbit around here. So I'm glad we got some use out of those
yeah,
little fellas.
So you mix it up. You pick it all off the bones. And then it still wasn't – you want it to, like, spread on a piece of toast kind of thing or something.
Oh.
So then
it, like a pâté. What's the difference between a rillette and a pâté?
Well, a rillette is more fat-based and actually has shredded meats in it.
Oh, shredded meats. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So then I melted some butter, and then that was the rillette. We also had a liver pâté that I made with Fred's Fred's cow's liver. That was quite good. Used a lot of oh, juniper berry kind of flavoring and things like that. Then what else did we do? Oh, the salad. Lana, can you explain how we did the salad? This was very meat heavy. So, you know, we are short on, this is not our best green season. And we weren't sure how the weather was going to be. This was a very last minute effort.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes. Donna was a little bit in a tiz because of the weather, and we didn't have green things coming up, at least in my garden. However, we have people that grow in greenhouses, bless their hearts. So we had
well,
things like
but
that.
More yeah. than that, we really based it on the garlic. What's it? Is it mustard garlic?
Garlic mustard.
Garlic mustard.
And this
Lana
yeah.
went woods picking for garlic mustard, and they're these beautiful little kind of. Well, the kind of round leaves.
Yeah, at this stage when garlic mustard first comes up, it's a little round leaf, and everyone is probably cringing when I say
it's
we
about
ate
an inch.
Garlic mustard because it grows. It is a weed. It is taking over the world here in Iowa. And once you have tasted it, it doesn't seem all that nasty anymore. Although it is a pretty rambunctious weed, and we were impressed and encouraged by Ava Chin talking
exactly.
on our show the week before, so we tasted it.
We put in the garlic mustard and the motherwort that we picked,
mm-hmm.
wild too,
thing we talked about.
And then of course more chives, and then I think my horseradish is just coming up, and the leaves are very tender. We put some of that in, and some more ramps from Adam Wilkie, and then we kind of rounded it out with some hoop house. A little bit of spinach, some daikon radish shoots, this is from Lee's Greens. And then we bound it all together with some Gary Guthrie carrots that he had been storing all winter long.
Oh, fantastic. This is the kind of small but very important change that we're going to have the pleasure of changing the world with. Let's eat local. A good plate of food is an expression of good agriculture. That's a
and good cool, community.
Yeah, that's
look at all the people that contributed to this. It was so much fun.
We'll take a little music break here and think about good food. Welcome back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. We're talking about a menu for an event that featured the chef Dan Barber. Donna had the great thrill and the great challenge and the great opportunity to whip up this dandy meal, and she's going through the menu with us right now. All sorts of local food. Local ingredients
and local people, our
yeah,
community
local people.
Participated.
Because what was so nice about this event is that not only people from the lecture group and the sponsors and all that kind of thing were there, but also Donna invited the farmers. The Kevin Dietzel, the cheesemaker, was there. And I learned a lot about cows from him. And Fred Kirchman was there, of course. And
the Shivers are farmers. The yep, Shivers family
yep.
was there.
So we talked food. And And Adam Wilkie was there, and he was a wonderful person that brought the rabbits. He also brought ramps. Can you tell me what ramps are?
Well, they're so tender. They're so beautiful. It's like a wide onion leaf, kind of. Wide, wild onion leaf.
Yeah.
And they are a really early spring delicacy.
Yes, it's a very slow-growing, wonderful wild perennial that you can find in actually kind of shady woods. Actually, it grows pretty much anywhere. Donna mentioned that she had garlic chives coming up and used that very much in her menu. And this is the kind of thing that just has been growing in the woods. I happen to live on a farm called Onion Creek Farm next to a creek called Onion Creek.
And with lots of woods. Lana has real woods.
We have woods. And I often wondered why would you name a creek Onion Creek? But I have found, as I get smarter, as I realize what I'm looking at, in the woods, especially kind of, I found a nice mess right by the creek, wild onions, wild ramps. They're wonderful. They sort of look like, a lily coming up.
Yeah, they do look a little bit like a lily of the valley kind of leaf, don't they?
Yeah, and they're very clumped together, and take as many leaves as you want. They're a very slow-growing plant, so don't yank out the whole plant, for goodness sakes. Leave some to keep propagating.
Yes, a lot of people do like to eat the bulbs. It's quite but be sure to leave plenty.
Right.
So they were featured in the menu in several places. They were decorative, they were delicious, and Adam Wilkie brought us a whole bunch of those.
So you talked about this being a slim time of year for showing off fancy things that grow here, but when you start looking, there's a lot of really wonderful things to enjoy. And like Dan Barber talked about, the joy of eating and the culture of agriculture is the knowing how to make the most out of what you have. And actually, the fact that we don't have green things all year sure makes us appreciate it when they show up.
It's so exciting right now. I'm out every day poking around. I call it the green lace season, you know, because it's just all the tiny little, if you look up at the trees, it starts to look very lacy.
Oh, I want to mention, too, you mentioned Gary Guthrie's carrots. And in central Iowa, we know Gary Guthrie as the Carrot King, a farmer who grows wonderful carrots. And we had some at your reception.
Well, Gary has this method. I felt very privileged. He called it at the very last minute and said, Donna, do you need some carrots for the Dan Barber menu? I said, oh, I would never say no. He has a first of all, he grows the most magnificent carrots, but, you know, that was last fall. So what he's doing is he stores them in sand in an old well or something like that. So he dug some of those carrots up for me, and by golly, they were pretty good. Not as good as, of course, when they're fresh harvested, but they were beautiful.
Oh, I happened to run across a really nice interview with Dan Barber, and he talked about carrots. So he waxed almost as excitedly about carrots as Gary Guthrie did. I thought about the same thing. He was the Brix level, the sugar levels, and he was going up and down on the difference between buying something that is mass produced. I guess carrots, you can really tell the difference if it's grown.
Oh, I think so.
Grown organically, grown small scale, so you can harvest at the right time and take care, and the variety that lends itself to hand handling as opposed to machine handling. Mm-hmm. And I ran across a really nice interview with Dan Barber by Krista Tippett. Krista Tippett has been on the radio for a long time. She has a show currently called On Being, and you can find her website and listen to downloads of stuff. Her website is onbeing.org, on being, one word. You can go there and look for the Dan Barber/88 interview, and she talks with him a long time. They talked about spirit, space, and food, the conjunction of spirit, space, and food. And you get to learn a lot about Dan Barber and lots of fun things going on. So look up that website. Also, I had the great pleasure of talking to Dan a little bit over this wonderful meal, and we were nibbling away there. And we were in Donna Prisgintis's kitchen, and I asked Dan Barber what he eats at home.
Yeah, I mean, we're pretty simple eaters at home, my wife and I. So, I mean, she eats a lot of vegetables and grains. And
how old is your daughter?
My daughter's two. She just turned two. So
that'll make the food simple.
Yeah, we've got definitely stripped things down. But I have a lot of fun cooking for my daughter. I'm actually not home much for dinner, which is delightful. So what do you have on the stove here?
Okay, this is the polenta. This is the early morning harvest corn.
Yeah, it's got a,
and then I've put, there's a smoked cheese that's coming out of Missouri that Mennonite farmers, so they actually really smoke it. And, you know, small farmsteaded. In the last year, we've gotten our own sort of, what's it called, flash freezer processing. So they're doing apples and corn. And the frozen corn is actually quite spectacular.
So wait, this is sweet frozen corn as well as planta?
You'll get a few whole. It's pretty good for frozen because they pull it right out of the field and flash freeze it in the same day. And they've managed to pick a variety that does well with that.
They grind it?
Delicious. Very exciting.
Yeah, it is.
Very delicious. So what's the variety of the plant?
I don't know. You know, I just go through and pick out the seeds that look right, and I save them for the next year. That's all I could get.
That's a dry corn.
Yeah. So, yeah, it is good. It's got a good corn.
And they grind it and then they...
Especially this time of year, you know, his warehouse is... I mean, it's small.
Yeah.
You know, his grinding room is like the size of my kitchen.
That was Donna Prisgintis talking with Dan Barber over a pot of polenta.
And we got bragging rights here in Iowa. This was Earl Hafner's early morning harvest corn polenta, and we've talked about this product quite a lot on air. Early morning harvest is from Panora, Iowa, and they do all kinds of freshly milled, organically grown, mostly on their farm, wheat, buckwheat, corn, rye. And so the polenta that we were talking about that Dan conceded is better than what he can get in his restaurant. And I'm thinking, my golly, if we can't grow better corn in Iowa than they grow in New York, we would be in trouble.
It was nice to give him a taste of something we are proud of. That is a wonderful way to travel the world, is to taste different things. And it's lovely to have something like we can tell people we've got the best of here.
Well, for me, the interesting part of the conversation was, of course, and I had also asked Earl, I said, what variety of corn are you growing? And he didn't have a name for it. And Dan asked the same question right away. What variety is this? This variety that Earl is growing is something that he's hand-selecting for the weight and the quality of the corn. So he's actually creating his own variety that is totally suited to his farm. And that is the real brilliance of it.
Yeah, talking about CSAs and buying local and small farms, talk about food with a face. There's a human element in this.
This is a whole family, too. It's the son, Jeff, and Earl, and I'm sure both of their wives and the grandmother. And it's always a lot of fun to go over to the Hafners. I always say Earl he's a farmer with like a frog in every pocket. He's always doing something.
And this very much fits into what Dan Barber was talking about, the idea of using not just the corn off of the farm, but
the buckwheat.
Because all of this stuff is important, growing all together and growing in succession.
And growing Earl's soil, because, of course, organic farmers cannot just grow corn and soy. You must at least have a third year of rotation to build up your soil, because you're not using artificial amendments. You're actually growing your soil, which is what Dan was talking about, which organic farmers know about, and Earl is one of the masters of it. So we were very proud to present a lot of products from Early Morning Harvest. It was also in the my neighbor Ingrid Anderson baked beautiful bread for the event with Earl's rye and wheat. And then, in the dessert, We didn't get to the dessert.
Well, I think it's about time we should get to
the dessert. Well, the dessert was really fun. So I made madeleines, which are these little French shell-shaped cookies, and I used Earl's wheat, you know, just his white pastry flour, and I used his buckwheat honey for the sweetener, and that was so delicious. And then with that, I also made a sort of a, I called it a creme fraiche gelato, but what I actually took was the Kelowna Organic yogurt and sour cream and just lightly sweetened it with, I think, agave or some kind of sugar syrup, honey syrup, but it was like a yogurty, but rich, not like frozen yogurt because it had the sour cream in it. So we had the gelato with the cookie, and then on top of it, from the freezer, I took out my black currants and I made little, it was made with gelatin, but they were very thick, more like a jam. So it was kind of like having little jelly babies of black currant jam. And we cut them in tiny, tiny pieces, like about a quarter inch by a quarter inch, and kind of studded them on the top of the ice cream. And it was marvelous.
I was impressed that the dessert looked like it was a real fuss because it has a lot of parts to it. Oh, was it pretty? And presented in little ice cream cups. It was a dandy way to end.
I must say, I have a collection of about 30 pressed glass, Green Depression glass sorbet cups. So they came out and in went the gelato, and it was really – it was the cap to the evening. We had a marvelous time.
It was. I had a really nice time getting to talk to Charlotte Shivers, one of the Shivers family, who recently at the lecture that evening actually had just received from Practical Farmers of Iowa. They got the Sustainable Agriculture Award for this year because of their family's good work on supporting good food and farming in Iowa. She recently wrote a...
Charlotte Shivers recently wrote an editorial
for the Des Moines Register, and it's entitled "How Eating from the Third Plate Can Help the Earth."
The third plate is the title of Dan's book, and the concept of the third plate is okay. The first plate is, you know, what we usually think of as meat and potatoes plate.
Mm-hmm.
The second plate would be kind of what we're thinking of as farm to table,
mm-hmm.
and then Dan is now describing the third plate as that cuisine, and he explains that he means cuisine as the cultural aspects of time and place. So that cuisine that really uses all the elements of the farm,
right? Learning to
all
use
the cover crops,
everything.
All of the everythings,
everything,
and the garlic mustard from the forest,
right.
And the
right. Da, da, da. He talked about something that he came up with at the Stone Barns restaurant. He called it rotation risotto. Rotation, using all the rotation that the grain fields that his supplying farmer was using.
And I have to say, he was very complimentary to the Iowa audience. He kept saying, when I talk in New York City and I mention what a rotation is, no one knows what I'm talking about. But you folks here know what rotations are. And yes, we do.
Yes, I looked around, and even though there were a whole lot of students sitting there with earbuds in and looking in their iPads and things, everybody was shaking their heads. We get it. Rotations, we have to put in lots of things. So his rotation risotto included not just the wheat that he originally wanted to buy, but all of the other kind of grains that would grow, and including all the brassicas, the kales, the mustards, and other things that grow as part of this, and the beans that grow as part of this whole cycle of producing a healthy farm. So he came up with something.
And he writes a lot in his book about a farmer in sort of western New York called Klaus Martens who is doing something very similar to what Earl Hafner is doing in terms of growing and milling his own multiple grain products.
Right. So eating from the third plate is kind of a new way of thinking of things. And eating from the third plate doesn't mean that, we have to just eat really boring food and only chew on raw corn. No. Eating from the third plate means that we open our palates and our eyes and our minds to new things. And Charlotte Shivers, I mentioned this editorial that she wrote, talked about the importance of taking care of the good earth that we were given. And she has a little bit here. I'll read it. It says, with the third plate, consumers would buy and eat what farmers have grown as they work to steward the land and water through the extended crop rotations and diversified crop livestock systems. Farmers tell us what they need to sell to improve the environment, and then we'd buy it. Now, that's quite a switch. What would this third plate look like in Iowa? We would drink beer made with Iowa barley and whiskey made with Iowa rye. We would lobby Quaker Oats to source Iowa-grown oats for our cereal. We would buy meat from farmers feeding their animals with a good percentage of Iowa small grains. We'd cook creatively with all the cuts of meat that farmers need to sell. We would buy as much food directly and preferably certified organic from farmers so that stewardship-minded farmers get the total share of the food dollar. To continue to eat well, or even to eat at all, any civilization must maintain soil health and understanding and reward the farmers in this effort. Now, for the most part, we are producing dirty water, deteriorating soils, and a bland cuisine. We could be producing clean water, building soil health, and eating delicious food, and supporting profitable and sustainable Iowa farms. So, we can use our food dollars and our choices to actually help the earth. Our food choices need to be a vote for the earth. That was some words of wisdom from Charlotte Shivers from an editorial she wrote recently. She had some
good thoughts. Which reminds me, the other thing that we produce here in Iowa that she mentioned and we had at the dinner, we didn't talk about the beverage table.
Beverages.
Oh, yes. So we have a new brewing company out at Prairie Moon Winery called Alluvial. And Elliot Thompson came with some of his beer product. And it's delicious.
Don't you just love the name Alluvial?
Alluvial. So we have Alluvial Brewing Company. So we had Elliot Thompson with his beer. And then we had several bottles of this is from the Mississippi Distillery, which is over somewhere on the Mississippi side of the state, I think kind of north of the Quad Cities. And they make a wonderful bourbon, a delicious rye, and we also had a corn whiskey. And on the corn whiskey bottle, it says, distilled from corn within 25 miles of the distillery. And I know that their practice is to buy all of their grains within 100 miles on either side of the river for their products. So do check out, what's it called? Oh, the Mississippi Distillery. And it's called Cody Road Whiskey or Rye or something. They have it at all the Hy-Vees and almost all the stores around here, too. So we had that on the bar, and then we also had Carolyn Raffensperger's homemade plum slivovitz. It was really good.
Slivovitz. I've heard that term, but I've never seen it written. That's S-L-I-B-O-V-I-T-Z, and that's another good word, like alluvial, slivovitz.
Oh. It's her home-brewed plum brandy from the plums right out of her front yard. She's getting very good at this.
It was delicious. Let's listen to another track of music. This is called The Big Reel. We're back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. You're listening to KHOA, Community Radio for the Heart of Iowa. This is Community Radio. We count on you as listeners. We count on you as people who send us money for our day-to-day operations here. And we count on your good energy. If you want to go to khoifm.org, you can find a great website there. You can also find the donate button, which is a real handy thing to know where it is. You can also download past shows, and also KHOI is streaming live. So if you've missed something, go back and find it. It's all there. It's easy to find your way around that website. Even I can do it. We've been talking about eating good food, eating locally, and the third plate with Dan Barber. Dan Barber is a chef from New York, and he is exploring and encouraging changing the way we eat to better suit our environment. He talks about eating nose to tail on the whole farm. Use everything, not just the fancy things. Everything is edible. Everything is good for us. He talks about changing the world, changing the way we look at things through pleasure. He's not beating us with a stick. He's saying, here, taste this. This is good. Donna had a wonderful dinner after the lecture that Dan Barber gave. We got to meet Dan, talk to some people, and she put together a wonderful meal, a wonderful menu. And along with having wonderful things to eat, the house was full of the smell of magnolia blossoms. And
yes, we used all local fresh,
right,
plucked flowers.
Yeah,
and they were put together in beautiful designs, these big branchy things there was one on the bar, there was one on the dinner table, they were all over.
There were some in the kitchen. Wasn't ever nice.
Absolutely. And they were all arranged by my good neighbor Lou Cathcart at Post Sprawl Design. She has quite an eye. So another member of everybody pitched in for this dinner.
It was nice. It looked beautiful. It smelled great. We had a wonderful gathering. And that evening, we had a fine spring thunderstorm to end
with
the evening.
With hail even. It was so much drama. It was wonderful.
Just the perfect night, the perfect night. Do you have anything else to say about planning a menu for something like this? I think you did a great job. That was quite a task.
Well, you know, the basic guidelines for planning a menu are, you know, how many people, how can you, especially if one is cooking and entertaining, the important thing is to plan it so that you have it done enough in advance that you can be present with your company and enjoy the meal yourself. So that I had to work that out because I was not going to miss the company of all of these wonderful people who showed up at the house, all the farmers and Dan and Fred and Carolyn and, you know, I'm a party girl, so I didn't want to be stirring all the pots. So one needs to kind of plan the timing of it. And then, of course, it's important to note the time of the year and the weather and the local ingredients available at the time. And so you kind of mix it all together and you have a little puzzle and you go, oh, and this would work and that would work. And it all comes out in a kind of process, you know, but don't just like sit down with an idea, oh, I'm going to cook a coq au vin, you know, kind of look at all the parameters of the event first and then let the food come from all the other things that are involved in the process.
And a fine time was had by all. It was very good.
Was delicious.
I have something I would like to share with our listeners, and it sort of harkens back to Carolyn Raffensperger's plum shrivovitz. But this is not plum, but it is a liqueur. I ran across this recipe in a book that Donna gave me. The book is called A Flavor Thesaurus, A Compendium of Pairings, Recipes and Ideas for the Creative Cook by Nikki Segnit, Segnit, from Bloomsbury Publishing in New York. This is not so much a recipe as it is an invitation to experimentation. This book is more like it says, a thesaurus. It just lists
flavors that combine well together, mm-hmm, across a spectrum. It's an interesting book.
Yes, and this author has put together actually a flavor wheel, like a color wheel. Mm-hmm. What goes next to what? And page on for page of list of ingredients and taste this, try this. Do you might want to try it with this? Or don't try that. Back and forth. It's really a fun book to flip through, and I happen to run across this flavor combination because I like these flavors. It's called Orange Coffee Bean Liqueur. And this recipe is on the Don and Lana Kitchen website. So go to khoifm.org, go to Talk Programs, find the Don and Lana Kitchen page there, and there's a whole list of recipes. And this is called Orange Coffee Bean Liqueur. I think I like this recipe because, like I said, it isn't really a recipe so much. It's more like a magic spell. This is exactly how it's written. You need to find a large jar first, a large jar to hold an orange. So don't be caught at the end without your jar. Okay, here you go. 44 coffee beans. Take a large orange and make 44 slits in it. Put a coffee bean in each slit. The orange will now look like a medieval weapon. Put 44 sugar cubes in a jar. I looked this up, so I just put 44 teaspoons of sugar in. I didn't have 44 cubes, but 44 sugar cubes or teaspoons in a jar. Position the orange on top of the sugar cubes. Pour over this 2 cups of brandy, rum, or vodka. Leave it to steep for 44 days. Then squeeze the juice out of the orange into the alcohol, discard the orange, strain and pour liquid into a sterilized bottle. Alternatively, and this is the fun part, leave the orange in the alcohol, put it in a dark, cool place, and forget about it completely. Find it covered in dust approximately 444 days later. Enjoy. That's my kind of recipe.
Oh, I'm looking forward to tasting that.
Great. Great. So, you have an upcoming event?
Oh, yeah. Tonight, Iowa State University is presenting Dr. Philip McMichael. The public lecture is called The Politics of Global Food Security. Philip McMichael is a professor and chair of development sociology at Cornell University, where he studies how the politics of the global food system are affected by global energy, financial and climate crisis, as well as the food sovereignty movement. So I think there will be some relevant information for us Iowans because we are a big part of the global food supply. That's tonight,
that's
7 p.m. at the South Ballroom at the Memorial Union. Dr. Philip McMichael, see you there.
That sounds lovely. Also this weekend, the Ames Public Library is having a book sale. Next week is Earth Day. There's farmers markets starting. We've been celebrating the joy of flavor. Donna shared her menu. Learn to taste. Eat from the whole farm. You've been listening to music by Wild Asparagus. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen with Lana Noctigal.
And Chef Donna Prisgintas.
With engineering by Rick Morrison. Eat good food and enjoy life.